Camp's simple logic is that the people consigned to them are putative subhumans or demons, dangerous or criminal, certainly enemies of the regime, the future, and goodness. So an eliminationist regime might as well benefit from the victims before killing or otherwise disposing of them. The Gulag's murderous nature and conditions were so great already in 1926, long before the Gulag became its most deadly in the late 1930s, that S.A. Maltsagov, in a camp on an island in the Arctic Sea, reported, "I gathered from the candid statements of the Czechists that the GPU has now no need to make a regular practice of mass shootings, because more humane measures, slow murder from starvation, work beyond the prisoner's strength, and medical help are perfectly adequate substitutes." If you are going to kill those people designated as enemies, as subhumans or demons, why not get them to work in the meantime? Mao revealed this logic to be explicitly guiding him in an order from May 1951. The victims, according to Mao, had committed crimes that deserved to be punished by death. But if they were immediately executed, we would lose a large labor force. So Mao sent them to a system of labor camps designed to house them under hellish conditions to produce some surplus. The perpetrators' knowledge that the camp's victims enjoy a momentary reprieve before execution, or their belief that the inmates are socially dead and can or must be eliminated, allows them to temporarily use the victims brutally and irrationally as workers. The Khmer Rouge, having caught Moli Lee leaving his slave labor village, where they had already reduced him to a worn-out skeletal figure craving food, sent him to a worse facility. "Once there, I was stunned to see only four women and a man. Without observing the clothes they wore, it was difficult to tell the difference between the man and the women. They had extremely fragile figures. Bones were popping out from everywhere in their bodies. At night, our feet were cuffed with a special kind of wood to prevent us from escaping. At dawn, we were dragged to work near the jail, plucking the soil. The next day, one of the women died in her sleep. Her ankles had been cuffed. I now realize that this was a death camp to cruelly torture people by starving and overworking them. Sometimes they threw food scraps at our faces and laughed. Other times we were beaten for being so exhausted from the hard work. I could no longer function like a human being. I knew in my heart that my spirit was going to die." If people slated for elimination end up producing something useful, all the better. May Kompot conveys the thoughts he had about Cambodian's situation around the time the Khmer Rouge had been in power for a month. He was in one of the hellish cooperatives with a pound of rice per day, the ration for an adult, no other food whatsoever, so 500 calories a day, minimal protein, virtually no vitamins and minerals. Children received nothing. The new Cambodian reality dawned on him. "I realized we were expendable. All the analyses we had done during the war, all of our ideas about what Cambodia would be like, were so wrong I had no room in my imagination for what was happening. I finally understood what it meant to be called by the Khmer Rouge cadres to study. Those people were murdered. Those of us who were spared were to become work animals. We were barely surviving." Even if in some camp systems attempts are made to enhance camps' productivity, many perpetrators' prevailing attitude has been that the prisoners should work for working's sake, the economic outcome be damned. Given camps' multiple economic irrationalities, it is no surprise that regimes putting people to work in camp systems rarely conceive of the work in any conventional sense and force people to work for various reasons having nothing to do with rational economics. The most obvious reason is by now clear. The perpetrators readily and variously exploit people they want to eliminate, including for labor. For many regimes, compelling the hated enemies to work also satisfies ideological dictates and is emotionally satisfying. Germans, beholden to anti-Semitic lore, deeply grounded in Christian accounts about Jews, including centrally in Martin Luther's writings, which held that Jews do not labor honestly, conceived of the simple act of labor to be punishment for Jews. Throughout their camp system, the Germans worked Jews just for the sake of working them. The harder, the better. This can be seen both in the work's abysmal organization and productivity, and in the Germans' frequent resort to productiveless labor, such as compelling Jews to run with big rocks or full sacks from one place to a second, and then back to the first, under the Germans' hail of blows, taunts, and laughter. According to one non-Jewish survivor from Buchenwald, "Some of the work in camp was useful, but some of it was utterly senseless, intended only as a form of torture, a diversion engaged in by the SS for fun. The Jews especially often had to build walls, only to tear them down the next day, rebuild them again, and so on." Communist regimes deemed the bourgeoisie and, in the case of Asian communisms, urban dwellers, to be class enemies, parasites living off workers' or peasants' sweat. In the Soviet Union's early years, it was dangerous to have uncalloused hands, which indicated that a person had not labored honestly and so was a member of the bourgeoisie. As an act of retribution and justice, communist regimes put these enemies to work. This is what Hendrik Fraser, a bastard accompanying the Germans in Southwest Africa, reported on the work they compelled captured Herero to perform. "There must have been about 600 men, women, and children prisoners. They were in an enclosure on the beach, fenced in with barbed wire. The women were made to do hard labor just like the men. The sand is very deep and heavy there. The women had to load and unload carts and trolleys, and also to draw Scotch cart loads of goods to Nonitas, 9 to 10 kilos away, where there was a depot. The women were put in spans of 8 to each Scotch cart and were made to pull like draft animals. Many were half-starved and weak and died of sheer exhaustion. Those who did not work well were brutally flogged with jambaks, heavy rhinoceros hide whips. I even saw women knocked down with pick handles. The German soldiers did this. I personally saw 6 women, Herero girls, murdered by German soldiers. They were ripped open with bayonets. I saw the bodies. I was there 6 months, and the Hereros died daily in large numbers as a result of exhaustion, ill-treatment, and exposure." This, too, qualifies as work. The prisoners produced some economic output, yet it was a small, incidental detour on the Germans' path to exterminating them. This was also true of the labor battalions Turks formed with Armenian soldiers in the Turkish army. An American hospital doctor reported on the Turks' treatment of these workers. "It was midsummer. They, the soldiers, were allowed no water and no rest, and were driven with clubs and gun stocks by the gendarmes. They stayed thus in this building without water for 3 days and even soaked the urine from the ground with handkerchiefs and drank it." What Beatrice Gatanya, a Kikuyu incarcerated in a British camp, said about the task the British made her and other Kikuyu women do, of fingerprinting decomposing bodies whose skin would just come off on them, is true of so much of victims' work under eliminationist regimes. "The job we were told to do was just to torture us." Of course, not all camp work and not all treatment of the ostensible workers has so shockingly little to do with economic productivity's norms and procedures as did the Germans, Turks, and Britons' practices. But a stunning percentage of it does. The perpetrator's relative emphasis on killing and immiseration, or on work, varies from camp system to system, and within a given system over time. On its face, the two are in inherent tension, assuming the perpetrators really aim for productive labor. Economic productivity requires everything camps often are not: using people's skills appropriately, husbanding human capital, having rational institutions and plants for work. None of these is typically present in any conventionally rational degree. Thus, camp systems tend to be economically irrational at their core. To the extent that perpetrators use camps to slaughter people rather than to keep them fit, they undermine the camp's economic purposes. To the extent that such a dehumanizing world prevents regimes and societies from maintaining minimal nutrition and health, productive labor is undermined across the board. But to the ideologized perpetrators, these contradictions matter not. Rithi Young explains, "The food wasn't the issue. All those Khmer Rouge people had plenty of food to eat. But they would not give it to us. They wanted us to work hard and starve to death." Camp systems' broad goals make them irrational labor institutions. Work's economic rationality is further undermined even while the victims are doing work because of the perpetrators' treatment of them. Just as many regimes conceive of work in ideological terms, so too do the perpetrators in camps. Communist regimes, drawing on Marxist theory, conceive of work as re-educative, even redemptive. Gulag is a Russian acronym for Main Administration of Corrective Labor Camps, and the Chinese called their camps labor reform camps. Working the regime's enemies, many of whom are seen as having shunned productive labor, is ideologically necessary, containing educative and punitive dimensions that Bukowski conveys when discussing the oxymoronic roles the perpetrators assigned prisoners as thankful slaves. The Germans' views of work as exquisite punishment for the putatively parasitical Jews governed the Germans' use of Jews' work more than conventional economic considerations. In the work camp Megdanek, the prisoners had morning roll call. "Then we went to work. In our wooden shoes we were chased by blows from rods into a corner of the field and had to fill sometimes our caps, at other times our jackets, with stones, wet sand, or mud, and, holding them with both hands and running under a hail of blows, bring them to the opposite corner of the field, empty the stuff, refill it, and bring it back to the opposite corner, and so on." A gauntlet of screaming SS men and privileged prisoners, armed with rods and whips, let loose on us a hail of blows. It was hell. The Germans' manner of employing Jews in camps was so utterly irrational and self-destructive that Joseph Schupak, the memoirist describing such work above, put "work" in quotation marks. Thinking of work as ideologically necessary, whether for re-educating victims or making them suffer, is bound to undermine labor's rational allocation and use, as it has in camp worlds across the globe. Getting prisoners to work, something socially useful, expresses and confirms the perpetrators' and their broader communities' subjectively just control of their victims. That prisoners, however coerced, appear to slavishly serve perpetrators gratifies them and seems to further validate their rule's justness. Thus, camps resemble slave institutions more than prisons, the inmates often functioning as slaves. However, unlike slaves, who often receive minimal legal protections, move among the enslaving society's general population, and can have relationships with a measure of subjective affection from their masters, the camp world's inmates are beyond the law, with exceptions ordinary social intercourse's realm, or affective ties with their masters. Beyond punishment, work serves as fulfillment or redemption. In the modern world, work is seen as not only economically valuable, but a mark of a person's willingness to contribute to a community. Therefore, getting people to work is its own end. This is true for prisoners eventually going free, making work a perverse re-educational school, or dying, making work an expiatory act. This most clearly existed in the German camps' early years, when many prisoners, the regime's political opponents, would eventually return to society, and under communist regimes, including the Chinese and Vietnamese, with their so-called re-education camps. For the Khmer Rouge, this was axiomatic. Young explains that the Khmer Rouge said they want to clean the imperialism ideas from you. So they told us, "Here are your hose. Here is the rice field. This is your school. Do it. Okay, you learn from the rice field and exactly what they say they preach to us every single day. And every single day after work, we had to sit down for a meeting and we had to criticize ourselves. What had we done wrong? In the warped worldviews of many eliminationist assaults perpetrators, an honest day's labor helps make an honest man, or at least the shell of one. A principal operational purpose of camp systems is degrading the victims, to make them understand their subjugated, demeaned, and rightless state. The men and women shaping or carrying out eliminationist projects are rarely policy's cool, detached, neutral executors. How could they be? The killers often wade in the victim's blood, spattering themselves with flesh and blood, bone and brain matter, after hearing their victim's mercy pleas and suffering cries, only to turn to the next victim, the next, and the next. Men doing this are not, in one writer's conceptually, descriptively, and morally obtuse language, mere shooters of victims, technical operators, trigger fingers in a non-moral technical enterprise. Guards in camps, even those not slaughtering victims, brutalize them, watch them starve to death, work them to the bone and beyond, let fester debilitating illnesses and conditions. The perpetrators want the victims to know who the master is. They want to refashion the victims according to their images of them. The Germans infamously reshaped their victims in camps, particularly Jews, Sintis, Roma, and Russians, quickly transforming them through malnutrition, privation, and neglect into beings physically resembling the subhumans of the Germans' fantasies, the worst off becoming mere skeletal human shadows verging on death, called Musulmaner, Muslims. The Soviets, in their brutal camps, without this kind of ideological intent, but no less deadly, created Dokhodyaga, Goner, the men who have been reduced to such a low level mentally and physically that even as workers they are of very limited value. The Khmer Rouge turned their commune's denizens into the atomized, robot-like, or animal-like, asocial beings they wanted for their dystopian fantasy future. During the day, recalls Savuth Pen, who was then a child, I would hunt for food like snakes and rats or anything that moved. This was allowed only during a short break after the long, labor-intensive work. My body was so thin and weak from lack of adequate nutrition. The other young boys were in the same condition as me. We looked like grandpas to one another. We rarely played or had long conversations because we lacked energy and tried to conserve it for the next day's work quota. In all cases, eliminationist perpetrators violently pry from their victims basic qualities marking people as full human beings. They deny the victims fundamental human bonds, ripping families apart, including parents from children, as they might divide different-sized stones into piles. They shear the victim's hair and deny them marks of individuality, including in clothing. They rob their names, renaming them, or reducing them to nameless tattooed numbers, as the Germans did in Auschwitz. They forbid them many basic human qualities of sociability, including, as the British did in Kenya, communicating with each other all day, except when in their barracks, including during backbreaking work. If the victims dare act as human beings instead of as their master's pliant non-human objects? For conversing, the Kikuyu prisoners could be punished and beaten individually or collectively. Karu Kibichu, a Kikuyu victim, once impermissibly spoke to another prisoner. The guard on the watchtower blew his whistle, and the askaris, who we called Rioti, riot squad, were set upon us all. They were using their hoe-handle clubs, clubbing us indiscriminately. Some of the detainees died from the beatings before we were all told to come out of our compound naked, holding our clothing and blankets in our hands. This was not done peacefully because the askaris were inside the compound beating us, and as we hurried out, there were others waiting for us, beating us some more. It was total mayhem, and the white man in charge just stood there screaming, "Piga! Piga sana!" Hit them more. Even regimes and perpetrators without such explicit ideological conceptions of their victims related to work tend to force their putatively demonic or subhuman enemies to work in camps to their limit and beyond. Furthermore, for some perpetrators, work becomes a convenient means of inflicting suffering without themselves as torturers. Perpetrators can think that if the victims were not such miscreants, they would labor harder, no matter how objectively false this is. And they see even excruciatingly hard labor as a socializing means, getting them to at least act as contributors to the common weal. Camp victims actually producing substantial economic output are often used as brute production factors. The perpetrators destroy their bodies, not to mention their souls, to get their relatively paltry returns. Mao formulated, already in 1933, the ideologically inspired notion of working people to death as production factors by having them do limitless forced labor. No rational economy would be run according to the camp world's principles, which often lead to annual workforce mortality rates of 10%. Zhao Yushu, the head of Fengyang country, epitomized the Chinese communists' utter disregard for economic rationality in camps and in general when he said during the Great Leap Forward, "Even if 99% die, we still have to hold high the red flag." Only a deeply ideologized and non-productively oriented regime and people, apparently as in North Korea, would conceive of constructing an economy along the lines of camps, whether German, Soviet, Chinese, British, or Khmer Rouge. The Khmer Rouge, having destroyed practically Cambodia's entire physical plant and, shunning modern machinery, shutting down the urban economy and all but ruining the agricultural one, compelled Cambodia's people to work growing rice and to fulfill the ideological need to work for working's sake, even in the most irrational ways. Tens of thousands of Cambodians died digging irrigation canals with the most primitive implements, including their bare hands, all to restore the Angkor Wat Empire's 12th century glories, which rested partly on agricultural canals. Excavating massive quantities of dirt and rock in this way has been a common feature of the German, Soviet, British, and Chinese camp worlds. One Chinese survivor of Mao's Great Leap Forward conveys the utter irrationality of labor use during this ideologically produced economic and human catastrophe when the communists dumped expellees in Manchuria's wilderness with no shelter, which they had to make using wheat stems in temperatures as low as minus 36 degrees Fahrenheit, minus 38 Celsius. With a fire, their huts warmed up to a dozen or so degrees below zero Celsius, or 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Yet, the grass and beaten earth huts we lived in had wind coming in from all sides. There were hardly any vegetables or meat. We got up just after 4 at dawn and did not stop until 7 or 8 in the evening. In these 15 to 16 hours, we basically worked nonstop. In summer, we had to get up at 2 a.m. We had, at most, 3 hours sleep. Although the landscape was different, Navi D describes the analogous irrationality of the creation and character of Cambodia's ostensible work camps. Those who survived the death march to the village of Mong arrived with almost nothing. When I got to that village, I saw only a few small houses, rice fields, and small irrigation ditches. We had to build our own camp under a mango tree with the other 10 families by using every scrap of our old clothes and plastic. Later, my father built a small barn for us. Mong was supposed to be very poor land. There was no river water, but a small pit with very dirty water. No orchids or fruit trees or even soil, but an empty desert with a few mango trees. About 300 families moved to this place, but three-quarters of them died from disease, starvation, and harsh, bloody torture. Only an ideologue, then or now, can see economic concerns or rationality governing the camp world and work. Put differently, economic purposes can be seen to have been at work only if one accepts these regimes and their camp world's eliminationist foundations and the perpetrators' dehumanizing or demonizing assumptions. This was explicit and striking in Kenya, where these features coalesced in an official policy. The British, desperate to hold on to Kenya, expelled most Kikuyu from their homes and regions, placing them in the unsustainable, deadly barbed wire villages. They declared the eliminationist exile permanent, as the colony's governor, Evelyn Baring, publicly explained. "There is no question whatsoever of irreconcilables being allowed to return to areas where loyal Kikuyu live." They then undertook a massive development plan for the Kikuyu, now forced to inhabit formerly uncultivated and inhospitable land. How did the British do it? With brute labor, slave labor, people used as production factors, including by compelling shackled Kikuyu victims to dig an 11-mile canal by hand. "This was the most miserable experience of my life," explains Charles Karumi. "Many men died from diseases, I think because we were so weak from the labor and beatings. The white man in charge kept yelling at us to keep working and ordered the askaris to set on us with their clubs if we moved too slowly." Only because the British had decided to eliminate the Kikuyu from their homes and deposit them in the middle of nowhere did developing this area of Kenya become seemingly necessary, as did working slaves brutally and economically irrationally, resulting in an enormous death toll of the putatively subhuman workers. Only in the context and assumptions of an eliminationist regime and program such as that of the British does working people so unproductively for development make sense. Once established, functioning camps cannot escape their inherent pathologies and contradictions. The desire to punish the prisoners, make them suffer, and make them understand their degraded and subhuman or dehumanized status. The subversion of economic potential by starving the camps of necessary factors and conditions of production, and the perpetrators' tendencies within the camp to abuse their absolute power for personal satisfaction. Camp system's enormous significance, as we see, is multifaceted. Whatever their many variations in size, victims, and the perpetrators' conceptions of them, duration, mix of eliminationist means, and overall destructiveness, camp systems institutionalize eliminationist policies as a core, if not the core, political thrust of regime and society. They integrate eliminationist policies and practices deeply into the broader societies and involve ever more people, often in vast numbers, from the state and civil society to run, maintain, and service them. In so doing, they steadily warp, or further warp, society's economic, social, and cultural spheres, in addition to its politics, not only by enmeshing ever more people in their assault on humanity, but also by creating perverse incentives and corrupting practices at all levels. While the camp world, like many institutions, tends to be self-reinforcing and self-reproducing and even expanding, the regimes building and maintaining camps also purposefully employ them throughout for political domination and destruction. Camp systems are significant for another reason. As systems of society, they encapsulate or contain the different worlds the perpetrators create. They are in themselves eliminationist worlds. They are communal worlds and are embedded in still broader communities. And they are sites where the perpetrators create personal worlds, especially through cruelty. In camps and elsewhere, perpetrators personally, face to face, inflict cruelty on victims, as to make cruelty many mass murders and eliminations' constituent feature. They are cruel to the victims in general. They are cruel to women in specific ways. They are differentially murderous and cruel to children. Personal worlds. Cruelty refashions worlds. For a victim, intense physical and psychological pain concentrates the mind exclusively on the pain itself, becoming his world. Acute pain alters the nexus of space and time as nothing else does. It compresses space so all one can apprehend is located on the often tiny afflicted body part. It changes the experience of time, elongating every second, every minute, every hour, every day. Each seems to stretch and drag on beyond what time's actual unit can contain and the sufferer can bear. Think of pain's instant effect on you, slicing your hand, hitting your finger with a hammer, or twisting your ankle. Think how your world shrinks in that elongated moment, which compared to eliminationist cruelty's victim's suffering is a droplet of intensity and duration. Multiply the pain, your world's shrinking, and the time's elongation by 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, by some indeterminably large number, and imaginatively enter the physical world of cruelty and suffering the perpetrators create for the victims. Then add the commensurate psychological and emotional suffering. The perpetrator's cruelty for the victims can, perhaps now somewhat, come into focus. For as long as the perpetrator's domination lasts, such cruelty refashions the victim's world, because even if a respite occurs, they know the perpetrators can and likely will resume. If the victims survive, such cruelty refashions their world forever. The victims never forget their pain, torment, and suffering. The horror will always cast a pall over their lives. It will likely become a life-defining experience, perhaps the defining one, to be relived and relived, whether they want to remember it or, much more likely, though they wish to forget it forever. For the perpetrator, cruelty also concentrates the mind. It is an unusual social moment most perpetrators have never had, rendering human beings into playthings. Some practitioners of cruelty turn the humanistic Kantian maxim, not to use people as means but to treat them as ends, on its head, toying with and hurting the victims for amusement, pleasure, and gratification. Other practitioners of cruelty expand the Kantian maxim into the definitive instance of using people as means and ends. They use the victims as playthings and inflict their cruelty for another purpose, to teach the victims, in the perpetrator's eyes, finally and properly, how abject they are. For the perpetrator, cruelty brings enormous satisfaction. He enjoys it. He revels in it. It invigorates and sustains him. He creates an out-of-this-world world for himself in the concentrated moment of flogging, battering, or dismembering his victims, and an out-of-this-world world for communities of cruelty as perpetrators share their joys collectively. The question is, what forms of cruelty do perpetrators inflict on the victims, and why? Cruelty is a common feature of eliminationist assaults. Cruelty is also an enormously significant aspect of them. It is significant foremost because the victims endure violence and suffering at their tormentors' hands. It is also significant because its perpetration tells us much about the perpetrators. Yet such cruelty remains little analyzed and poorly understood. Without taking up the fine conceptual and psychological aspects of defining cruelty and torture, we can say the perpetrators know their victims suffer, and while they, at least in principle, might not wish their victims to suffer excessively beyond the already enormous suffering their eliminationist assault and act itself require for their execution, they minimally are at least willing, almost always gladly and rarely with lament, to inflict that high baseline of suffering. In an expansive notion of torture and cruelty's meaning and universe, eliminationist policies and their acts themselves might rightly be seen as cruelty, if not torture. Many countries' legal systems and people consider the death penalty cruel and inhumane punishment. Treating exterminationist acts as inherently cruel is an easily sustainable position. The same could be said for other eliminationist acts, such as driving people from their homes or incarcerating them in camps. Death marches are almost always a particularly cruel way to kill people, as the perpetrators themselves recognize. When missionaries asked a Turkish perpetrator why the Turks did not kill women and children on the spot and chose instead to make them so wretched by sending them on a death march, he explained that in addition to being a good way to prevent corpses from stinking up their villages, it is right so. They must become wretched. Nevertheless, for analytical purposes, I leave the eliminationist acts themselves aside and consider only perpetrators' acts of cruelty and torture going beyond what is strictly required of them in eliminating the victims. When a person's task is to kill someone, he need not gratuitously beat, torture, or degrade that person first. He need not take initiative to augment her suffering. Yet perpetrators routinely do, so much so that in the killing act itself in one of the eliminationist assaults where it is most frequently said the perpetrators were conscripted and had no choice, the perpetrators subjected an amazingly high percentage of the victims to enormous gratuitous cruelty and suffering. When asked what overkill means, Freddy Peccarelli, head of the Guatemalan Forensic Anthropology Foundation, processing victims' remains uncovered in mass graves, explains, "Well, see, overkill would be associated, like I said, to many different strikes or many different impacts when they're not necessary to cause a person's death. And they're more geared to brutality and to this part of human nature that I don't fully understand when things get out of hand and it becomes a matter of just making this person pay for something or making a point of the killing." Asked to estimate the percentage of victims on whom the Guatemalan perpetrators inflicted overkill, Peccarelli replies, "I would say maybe between 15 to 20%." This incredibly high number comes just from the moment of the kill, just from assessing the small percentage of all the perpetrator's cruelties, cutting all the way to and incising marks into the victim's bones. The skeletal remains being all the forensic pathologists can investigate decades after the fact, and just from the bones uncovered for each victim, many skeletons being far from complete, leaving many additional instances of even-to-the-bone overkill undetected. By no means are the perpetrators cruel toward their victims and torturing them only when killing them, but far more often when they are guarding, herding, or just passing by them. In Kenya, Major Wa Wanjiru, a notorious killer, and his men regularly tortured Kikuyu before killing them. Esther Muchiri describes an episode where the perpetrators stripped her and several dozen men and women naked. "We were beaten the whole day until evening when we were separated from the men, who were ordered to sit a distance away with their hands cuffed together. Then the interrogators started to squeeze their private parts with a pair of pliers. There was only a short distance between where they were and ourselves. I even saw one of them being hit on his face, a blow that sent him sprawling down unconscious. A whole bucket of water had to be poured on his body to revive him. The same evening, the men were loaded onto a vehicle and driven away. We were to learn the following morning that all of them had been executed." Such cruelty that is unnecessary for carrying out the eliminationist act itself, whether or not during the act of killing or elimination, constitutes excess cruelty. In eliminationist and exterminationist assaults, excess cruelty is a commonplace, and it varies widely from one eliminationist assault to the next. Both these aspects and their sources are significant and need to be explored if we are to understand our time's mass murders and eliminations. There are different kinds of excess cruelty. A two-dimensional matrix, with one dimension being whether the cruelty is ordered from above and the other being whether it is individually or collectively performed, specifies four kinds of excess cruelty. Collectively performed cruelty ordered from above is organized and structured. Collectively performed cruelty not ordered from above is group performance. Individually performed cruelty ordered from above is supervised. Individually performed cruelty not ordered from above is individual initiative. In the annals of eliminationist assaults, individually supervised cruelty is rarely ordered from above. A second kind of cruelty, ordered or governed from above, which is collective and not performed by individuals, is exterminationist and eliminationist programs' constitutive feature. This organized and structured cruelty is embedded in the fabric of the world the perpetrators create for the victims. It includes the pain and suffering in how they house them, undernourish them, systematically punish them, transport them, and generally mistreat them, including by tearing families apart. Camps are such cruelty's quintessential sites. Perpetrators create them in a manner guaranteeing the victims will suffer such cruelty, regularly, daily, and nightly, often in virtually every moment and aspect of life. Work, a central feature of camp life, often as the perpetrator's explicit intention and almost always effectively, is classic structured cruelty. Having just explored camps and their multifarious structured and often unstructured cruelties and their variations, the discussion here concentrates on the cruelties not ordered from above, on individual excesses and group performances, although the analysis often pertains also to structured cruelty, especially in camps. Killing, in a manner inflicting maximal suffering, systematic torturing of individuals, beating, brutalizing, maiming, sexually abusing, ritually degrading, mocking, using victims as playthings and more, is the hallmark of eliminationist politics and onslaughts. Clementine, a Hutu from Nyamata, describes how the killers sometimes returned from a search-and-destroy mission with a victim, whom they brought to the marketplace. These doomed victims were usually acquaintances who had tried to cheat to pass for Hutu, for example, or people who had been rich and important before, or acquaintances disliked because of old quarrels. The killers would call everyone to watch. All the women and children would gather to see the show. There were people still carrying drinks or nurslings on their backs. The killers would cut off the victims' limbs. They would crush their bones with a club, but without killing them. They wanted them to last. They wanted the audience to learn from these torments. Shouts would rise up from all sides. These were raucous village jamborees, quite rare and quite popular. This account's elements are instructive. For these ceremonial torture performances, the perpetrators usually chose a known person, one particularly incensing them. There was an element of score settling. Yet the score could be for an act not injuring the perpetrators individually, but transgressing against the Hutu collectively, something as impersonal as a Tutsi trying to pass for a Hutu. It may be that personal acquaintanceship was also important because it provided the perpetrators and the onlooking community the joint opportunity to teach the victim more meaningfully what happens to Tutsi trying to cheat or cross the Hutu. The more personal it is, the more the victim understands his abject state as his life dissipates in agony. The perpetrators did not seek to hide their deeds. They were not ashamed of their butchery. The opposite. They celebrated their deeds. More, they expected, correctly, that their community would joyfully share in their celebration. All the women willingly came to watch. They brought their children. Perhaps most significant, aside from the victim's unspeakable suffering and the perpetrator's unspeakable cruelty, which were the basis of collective enjoyment that became the whole community's festive, raucous affairs, was the perpetrators elongating the misery because they wanted the audience to learn from these torments. To learn what? Obviously not torture's techniques, but the right way to treat a Tutsi. That is why the perpetrators made especially sure the children attended these episodic educational sessions. These jamborees were popular affairs. They reflected the popular will and further helped to cement it with the celebratory dismemberings that produced this Durkheimian collective effervescence or euphoria. The community was saying to itself, Tutsi should, even must, be treated in this manner. Dwelling even briefly on eliminationist assaults, personalized violence, and cruelty is enough to sicken anyone possessing a shred of fellow feeling. to sit before and listen to victims around the world recount the cruelties they suffered, as I have, is all but unbearable. Yet to the perpetrators as individuals and often as a class, and even to the broader societies from which they come, this fellow feeling has been blunted for contemplating the targeted groups, and even when watching them suffer collectively and individually. More revolting, this fellow feeling has been corrupted and inverted so that, for perpetrators and their approving bystanders, the most horrifying acts become self-righteous justices, satisfying, even aesthetically pleasurable, expressive displays. The prejudice, hatred, and enmity moving perpetrators to kill, expel, or otherwise eliminate the victims of their mental and emotional animosity also predispose them to want to take other retribution, as they understand it, upon them. After all, they are killing, forcing from their homes and country, or incarcerating in hellish camps people they deem less than fully human or demonic, or consider to have already greatly harmed or to be threatening to harm them and their loved ones. It would be unusual if the perpetrators did not treat the victims extremely brutally, with excess cruelty. Given how easily human aggression is switched on, especially in situations of actual or potential face-to-face physical conflict, which any personalized eliminationist moment is, and how satisfying aggression's venting can feel, it is no surprise that excess cruelty is virtually the constituent feature of eliminationist programs. Nevertheless, enormous differences exist. Sometimes cruelty is institutionalized, namely ordered from above or embedded into the rules, practices, and patterns of given eliminationist situations or institutions, such as camps. Sometimes groups collectively perform cruelty in patterned ways. Sometimes individuals take their own initiative to make their victims suffer excessively. It needs to be emphasized that, just as illuminating similarities and differences among different eliminationist and exterminationist assaults does not value any victim's lives more or less, or make a person's death in one onslaught any less or more meaningful or tragic than another's death, neither does comparing cruelty, brutality, and torture make one eliminationist assault morally worse or more meaningful than another. As we know, camps are places of extreme, deadly privation. The American camps, however inadequate and horrible, interning more than 100,000 Japanese Americans, being the exception. Perpetrators, those creating the camp's overall conditions and those manning its daily operations, normally systematically, extremely, and callously disregard the prisoners' well-being. Yet some camps and camp systems direct far more organized or more personal cruelty at the victims. Comparing the full character and extent of such excess cruelty from camp system to camp system, not to mention from one eliminationist onslaught to the next, requires far more knowledge than we have or are likely to acquire of many systems, given their vastness, the highly incomplete to non-existent records, in no small measure owing to the witnesses' deaths, and the certain variability from camp to camp, from killing locale to killing locale, within each vast camp system and larger eliminationist programs. Nonetheless, concerted research projects into every camp system's and eliminationist program's cruelty would considerably enhance our understanding of cruelty's commonalities, patterns, and variations, and therefore of eliminationist programs themselves. The eliminationist assaults we know the most about, the Germans' various programs against the Jews, mentally ill, Sintis, Romas, Poles, Russians, and others, and an eliminationist camp system we have recently learned much more about, that of the British in Kenya, illustrate, by themselves and when compared to other eliminationist assaults, several critical distinctions among types of cruelty that help us better understand cruelty's sources and nature. To begin with, the evidence is overwhelming that the Germans' cruelty toward Jews was virtually unsurpassable, not in the sense that other perpetrators did not commit unspeakable brutalities against their victims, because, as the sickening evidence presented here from so many eliminationist assaults unequivocally demonstrates, they did. Unlike other eliminationist perpetrators whose cruelties consisted mainly of time-limited torturing and literally butchering their victims to death, or episodic cruelties over longer periods, the Germans were cruel to their Jewish victims steadily over extensive periods, daily and hourly, with an incessantness and drive that is singular and gave the appearance of people acting on a compulsion. A work camp the Germans set up just for Jews they were keeping alive to work, the Lipowa camp near Lublin, Poland, is illustrative. Virtually all of Lipowa's personnel carried whips or some functional equivalent, and the survivors' testimony makes clear almost all used the whips frequently, energetically, and willfully without being under any supervision, striking the Jews often arbitrarily and without any apparent cause, even by the Germans' liberal notions of causality. In addition to such quotidian use of whips, the Germans' routine cruelty took particular forms including brutal beatings with whips into which small iron balls had been wrought, incarceration in a bunker for indeterminate time, beatings in a bunker on a special whipping table one of the Germans had invented specifically for such occasions, forcing Jews to run the gauntlet, torturing Jews with electric shocks, compelling Jews to stand for hours barefoot in the snow after waking them with blows, public hangings which terrorized the Jews still more than unseen executions. Of the 46 members discussed during the post-war legal investigation of the camp's personnel, survivors indicate only three who departed from these cruel practices, one beating them only when under supervision, which shows that the others, able to do the same, chose not to. Day after day, time after time, they chose to be cruel and torture the Jews. When German perpetrators testify that beating Jews was, in their common phrase, their daily bread, they convey how regularly and reflexively they beat them. In another sense, beating Jews was, like bread for their bodies, daily nourishment for their psyches, sating their seeming persistent need to make the Jews suffer. If a person innocently surveyed the Germans' treatment of Jews in camps, their constant physical and symbolic degradation and cruelty toward utterly helpless and defenseless people whom they had, by starving them, turned into barely alive, skeletal, and sore-infested creatures, he might have concluded, if judging just by the evidence of his senses, that the Germans kept the Jews alive to gratify a desire to make them suffer. Or, since their conduct appeared to have no other rational purpose, to satisfy some unknown cosmological principle requiring Jews' suffering akin to the Aztecs' belief that daily human sacrifice was necessary to make the sun rise. The Germans' cruelty toward Jews was more frequent and intensive than their also brutal, often extremely brutal, treatment of other victim peoples. The Germans' cruelty is so significant analytically because it demonstrates definitively that the perpetrators' varying conceptions of the different victim groups systematically and commensurately govern their relative brutality and cruelty toward victims. From camp to camp, outside camps, across different settings and different units, the same uncoordinated pattern of hierarchical brutality toward different victim groups emerged during the Germans' continent-wide predations. Paralleling different groups' differing mortality rates in camps, the Germans' general treatment of and cruelty toward the Jews, the putative anti-human demons, was the worst. Toward the Russians, those putative Bolshevik-bearing subhumans, the next worst. Other putatively subhuman Slavic peoples, the next worst. Western Europeans, better. Nordic Northern Europeans, the best. So, where the same structural conditions existed in a given camp and then in camp after camp, of the German perpetrators as absolute lords equally over all the defenseless incarcerated peoples, the Germans treated the different victims markedly differently, the Jews receiving such manifestly worse treatment that even non-Jewish prisoners comment on it.